Do you ever feel like you're constantly paying the tab for the decisions that your younger self made? Imagine someone taking all of these moments, the hilarious, the painful, the eye-opening, and turning them into a brutally honest, no-punches-pulled book. Andy Dietrich, our guest today, did just that. He went from being a German kid who was dropped into Alaska, of all places, to becoming a Marine, and he talks about some of the difficulties that he encountered, including learning some of the American slang the hard way. And talking about his book, writing Play Stupid Games, Win Stupid Prizes. And you know, Andy's stories, they're just raw, funny, and unexpectedly powerful. And so this episode takes you inside those moments, both the laughs, the gut checks, and it talks about the mindset behind owning your story, no matter how ridiculous it gets. But before we get into this episode, I do want to take a quick moment here to raise awareness for something deeply important to our community, the Global War on Terrorism Memorial Foundation. This organization is working to build a permanent national memorial in Washington, D.C. to honor the service members, families, and civilians who were impacted by the Global War on Terrorism. This memorial serves as both a tribute to those who served and a way to ensure that their sacrifices are recognized and remembered for generations to come. So if you want to learn more or find out how to support the mission, visit gwattmemorialfoundation.org. Now, let's get into today's episode. Andy, welcome to the show. I'm really glad to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to get a little bit into your story and your background. You know, and you've written a book. It's called Play Stupid Prizes. I want to get into that in just a minute. Could you tell a bit about you and your background, kind of your military history, that sure. Kind of thing? Then we can jump into the...
Yeah, I'll give you my paragraph version of how I started and how I ended up here. So
yeah, sure.
I was born in Berlin, Germany. I lived there for a good part of my adolescence. And then at 14, my mother and I moved to Alaska, of all places. There's a little side story that goes along why that happened and you know, the experiences that one gets living up there. And at 19, I decided to join up. I enlisted in the Marine Corps, spent 4 years stationed in Camp Pendleton. There were some interesting stories, maybe some unsavory moments I can share from that time as well, a little bit later on.
Sure.
And then in 2008, decided to move to Vegas. And I've been here for about 20 plus years now. And yeah, I don't see myself leaving anytime soon. And yeah, that's me in a nutshell.
Excellent. Excellent. So yeah, definitely not the place I would have thought, you know, most Europeans would think of as like the first stop for America.
Yeah.
You know, coming over here. That's
I would tell my friends that, oh, we're moving to America because Alaska was, you know, part or still is part of America.
Yeah.
As I then found out pretty quickly, Alaska is kind of seen as the ugly redheaded stepchild of the United States, but a very rich, loaded, ugly redheaded stepchild of
sure.
the United States. So that's why we keep them around, right?
Yeah, right.
There definitely were some growing pains, right? Culture shocks, you know, language barriers, and you know, just a lot of things that go with being a 14-year-old and trying to fit in and being the kind of like the outsider, because Fairbanks, where I lived, is a very small town. The high schools are even smaller. So I was the new kid, the German kid, right? So trying to fit in while you're a sore thumb sticking out wasn't exactly the easiest task.
Did you speak English when you got here, or did you have to learn when you got here?
Yeah, some. So they taught us British English, like proper school English, from the fifth grade on up in Germany. So I had a good starting base of the language.
Well, that's
but you know, having a learning a language for a couple of years from a traditional British he's a German that spoke British English with his thick German accent, and so did all of us.
Sure.
Learning a language out of a book is much different from conversational English, which is then much different from, like, say, a technical English, right?
So yeah, sure.
There's a lot of things that I had to learn pretty quickly just to keep up in school and to keep up with you know, the kids my age, because slang and other sayings, things like, you know, knocking on wood, or the phrase "and then some." I always thought "and then some what?" You're missing a word here. Like, "and then some what?" What's happening?
Finish the sentence, damn it.
Right. Don't leave me hanging.
That's funny. Yeah, no, I was just asking because it's interesting, you know, when people go from one culture to another. I was talking to somebody just today who moved to Japan, had to learn Japanese, and it was a culture shock for him as well from the United States. And so it's just interesting to hear the stories and how you get there. And I'm sure there were some words that you fumbled and made some mistakes along the way. But, you know, I think that's how we all learn. Anyways, not just language, but with anything in life, we learn through the mistakes that we make. Absolutely. And we say, well, I don't want to make that mistake again. So I'm especially going to learn how not to do that again. Yeah, right.
I'm reminded that, as you said, that learning words, I'm reminded of a quick story where I was working at a coffee shop. And one of my first jobs, I was 15, 16 years old. And the boss called up and she says, hey, are we out of anything? Do we need anything? Do we need to go to the store and buy stuff? And I said, yes, we're out of jalapenos. She goes, excuse me, what? And I said, well, jalapenos. And she goes, what are you talking about? And I said, you know, the spicy green things with the seeds inside. She goes, oh, you mean? I go, hold on a minute. It starts with a J. How does a J sound like an H sound? Right? To me, as a native German speaker, that completely threw me for a loop. But I didn't know that jalapenos is not even, you know, it doesn't have English roots, right? So the J doesn't sound like a J, right? Stuff like that. So jalapenos, fajita, right? Fajita, right? Words like that, kind of, you know, there were some growing pains along with that.
Well, that's even harder because you're throwing another language mix too when you get Spanish in there. And it just makes things so much harder. But anyway, so that's, you know, I love hearing people's backstories and their background and everything like that. I'm sure we'll get more into your military career and some of the adventures that you might have had through that career. But let's talk about your title of the book, Play Stupid Games, Win Stupid Prizes. Where did that come from? I'm judging the book by its cover
Right? And I think the which is short stories about friendship, growth, social misdemeanors, I think up or kind of gives you an idea of what the book is all about, right? They're short stories, talks about my personal mishaps, things I've gotten myself into, and mostly using my big mouth. And then also stories that are a lot more sincere. Not that my other stories aren't sincere, but they're supposed to be with a lighthearted attitude. I also talk about some friends, you know, that we've shared moments together, right? So there are some more touching stories along my other shenanigans. And the title really came from I like the phrase. I've used it for a long time. It's kind of like the phrase, oh well, if it isn't the consequences of my own action, right? I'm a big believer that you're ultimately responsible for dealing with your issues. Now, you may not always be, at fault. You may not always be responsible for things that happen to you, but you always have to take ownership of it, right? You always have to deal with it. Nobody else will deal with your life for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is absolutely true. And that goes with everything. You learn that real quick when you join the military.
Oh, yeah.
That's maybe day one in basic training. If you mess up, they're going to let you know you mess up, and you're going to have to deal with those consequences. Sometimes the whole group's going to have to deal with those consequences.
The worst one, and I think our veterans can agree with us on this, the worst one is when you messed up in boot camp, and the entire platoon is then punished, yet you're the one standing there and to watch everyone doing their push-ups and such. That sends a message, and that weighs on you pretty heavily. I'm not saying that I ever did that. I'm not saying I was ever on the receiving end of it. But, you know, I can only imagine the kind of weight that puts on you.
I remember being one of the ones pushing and doing the push-ups and just looking at the guy who screwed up. And it's like, man, what were you thinking? It was like such stupid stuff. But then, you know, we all make mistakes along the way. And so, I get it. It's all part of the game. Worse, though, for us, during basic training, talking about playing stupid games and winning stupid prizes during basic training, we were there for April Fool's Day was one of the days that we were there, and the drill sergeants came running into the barracks in the morning, still sleeping, and they flipped on the lights and they started screaming at us. We're like, what the hell went wrong? Like, no one even was up at this point. Right. What could we possibly have done wrong? And they started telling us that one of the recruits must have written some graffiti in the hallway on the wall, and it was something about one of the drill sergeants, and they were like, we're gonna figure out who it is and we're gonna smoke until we figure out who it was. They had us out in the PT field. This was an all day thing from the time we woke up to the time we went to bed.
My God.
They were smoking us. It got to the point where people were falsely accusing other people of doing just, it. Yeah, just to get it to stop.
It's like North Korea all over again, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it got so bad, and there were fistfights that were breaking out amongst the recruits because it's like, no, I didn't do it. And yes, you did. No, I didn't. Turns out the whole thing was an April Fool's joke.
Not so funny on you guys, though.
No, not so funny. The drill sergeants were having a blast with it, though. They were laughing so hard. And the next day, it was as if nothing happened. And they didn't mention it again until, like, I think like a day or two before graduation, one of the recruits just got the courage up and he was like, what was that all about? And they're like, oh yeah, April Fool's, by the way. So
you're like, great. Like, it's just great. There's nothing you can say or do. It's just great.
Great. Yeah. Thanks. You know, and you know, all the, like a few months later, it's like, okay, fine. That was kind of funny actually, but
looking back, right.
Most
of basic training while you're in it, you hate every minute of it. And then you look back, you're like, yeah, it was a good time. I would never want to do it again, but I had a good time.
Right. Yeah. I remember thinking they're actually paying me to shoot these guns right now. Like, that's pretty cool.
And you get a workout.
Yeah. And you get a, you know, workout. No big deal. Right. So getting back to the book, what motivated you to write this book? Like, where did this come from, and what's get out of it?
So it's always been a bit of a passion project. I think everyone has like that labor of love, the passion project that they want to get done, whether it's rebuilding an engine, right, for a, you know, 68 Chevy, or it's writing a manuscript, or I don't know, making a sculpture, or whatever it is. I think everyone has this one thing that they want to get done. And, you know, people always think about it. They always maybe sometimes talk about it. And, you know, and I think, you know, I realized that I was telling the same 20 stories over and over and over. And just like a comedian on stage, once you kind of rehearse the same story for long enough, you get the timing right. You get the punchline right. The story turns into a flow instead of, instead of sentences. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, maybe I have enough here to put it, you know, on paper. And one of my biggest worries was 4 months of work into it, and I'm only come up with, say, 40 pages worth of material. Well, that's not a book. That's a pamphlet, right? And I didn't want to publish a pamphlet. But then I went at it and started, you know, putting more and more text on paper, and I ended up being about 160 pages, and I said, we got something here. And I'm happy with the result. It took me about two and a half years. Now keep in mind that also was with like 3 months off here and 4 months off there. The writing definitely in spurts. It came in waves. And then there was times when I'm like, look, I'm 80% there, and then I just drag my feet for the last 20%. So it, like I said, it was a labor of love, passion project. And I literally told nobody about this until it was done. I did not want to be one of those girls that talks about their project and nothing ever gets done with it, right? They remind people every 2 or 3 months of it, and people give them that, oh yeah, great, we can't wait to see it. And then that person gets a little dopamine drip from it. I didn't want to be that guy. Like, I wanted to have the proof be in the pudding and have it be done and published, and then I could tell people, hey, I did something.
Right. And you know, there's actually a psychological thing that happens when you do what you just were describing. When you go and tell someone, hey, I'm writing a book, and everyone's, oh, wow, great, good for you, and that's wonderful. When you get that sort of feedback, the feedback is actually almost the same thing as if you actually did it and completed it and crossed that finish line. Mm. And so to you, like you said, you got that dopamine hit. If you were to have done that, you get the dopamine hit, and then you don't really have the motivation, because the motivation is the dopamine hit as you're crossing that finish line. If you say, I'm going to go run a marathon, and I'm like, oh, well, good for you. You know, that sounds amazing. It's probably not exactly the same as if you actually ran a marathon. But if I said that, you're like, oh, wow, well, you know, I already have that. I already got the congratulations.
Okay. Why do I need to bother?
Why do I need to put all the work in?
Okay. You know? I can see that.
Hey, by the way, I'm building a rocket ship, and I'm going to go to the moon.
Oh, good for you. I can't wait to see it.
Good. I'll let you know when it's done.
Put a camera on it and then send it to the flat earthers, and they'll still tell you it's fake, right? You must be working for NASA. You're part of the big conspiracy, too.
Yeah.
Now, one thing I don't get about, completely segueing for a second.
Sure.
I'm totally fine with skepticism. I'm fine with people asking questions, but why, and can we test it, this, that, and the other. One big hole that I can easily poke into flat earthers, the flat earth belief, I can't even believe that it's becoming a, or has become, small yet very outspoken, very vocal group of misinformed people. I was going to say something else, but let's just go with misinformed people. If there truly was a flat Earth, let's go with it for a second. If there truly was a flat Earth, we would have no sunsets. The sun would just get smaller and smaller and smaller in the sky, and then would come bigger and bigger and bigger during the day. Like it would not set under a horizon or behind a horizon. It wouldn't make any sense.
Unless it just went under us.
But then...
right. But then
see, now you're thinking like a flat earther, right? I know. Now you're poking holes in my theory.
I'm starting to poke holes. That's right. Know? But, anyways.
Yeah, I can't put some people. Anyway.
No. Sometimes it just doesn't make any sense. But anyways. So tell us a little bit more. Dive a little bit more into this book. You kind of told us a little bit about kind of the inspiration behind at least the title. But talk to us a little bit about kind of like how it's broken out and, what people can expect.
Format is, it's short stories, again, about myself, my shenanigans. First half is broke. The first half consists of, I call them silly stories, right? We can go into some samples here in a second. Basically just silly shenanigans, right? Lighthearted fooleries, things I've got myself into, just using, questionable decision. And the second half, introspective opinions. I have some rants, reflect on some more serious happenings that have had life. I talk about briefly about, the reality of my military service. So it's, the first half is to invoke, kind of like, you're supposed to enjoy the thing from start to finish, but the first half is supposed to be a little lighthearted. The second half is supposed to be a little more somber, a little more serious topics, and hopefully, give you a little bit of room to think about, my thoughts and my opinions, and go from there.
So what are some examples of maybe a little bit of the lighthearted, a little bit of the kind of maybe some of your pieces from your military service, and maybe we can get into that a bit.
Absolutely. So I think for your veteran audience, you would probably appreciate this. Okay. So I was stationed in Pendleton, Camp Pendleton, Southern California, and I had a Alaskan driver's license. Like I said, I was spent some time in Fairbanks. So I went to the PX one day and I decided some booze. I go to the counter and the young woman said, she asked me for ID. I said, sure. And I gave her mask and driver's license. And she looked at it and she goes, huh, Alaska. Now, mind you, you don't see a lot of Alaskan driver's licenses down in Southern California, especially not on the PX, right? Yeah. Or rather on base. So this young woman, bless her heart, she looked at this ID and she goes, huh, Alaska. It must be pretty warm down there. I'm going to let you noodle on that for a second, right? Like, what in the world could you possibly have meant, right? So I was kind of dumbfounded for a second, and I said, down there? She goes, yeah, down there.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Okay,
now.
You probably clicked. Okay, all right.
It just clicked.
And I was like, I don't understand. Where do you believe Alaska is? And she goes, oh, down by Hawaii. And I go, where do you see Alaska down by? And she goes, well, the weather forecast when they have, the Alaska and Hawaii next to it. And I go, oh, okay. I could, no, honey, no. I said, no, Alaska is way up north next to Canada. We get -40, in the wintertime. And then she kind of pauses for a second. She looks at me kind of weird and she goes, are you sure? I'm like, no, bitch. I just lived there for 4 years. Of course I'm sure. Like, what do you want me to tell you? Of course it's all the way up there. Bless her heart. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's one. And then the other one I'll share is, so we had a company commander. His name was Captain Morrison. Now, mind you, I was a young enlisted man. I was, 19, 20 years old, Lance Corporal or Private First Class, whatever the hell, some E1, E2, E3, rank. And this this captain, his name was Captain Morrison, Abraham Morrison of Jewish descent. Okay. But kind of early on that I had, that I was of German heritage, and I still had a fairly thick German accent back then. So, and he had a good sense of humor, and we kind of joke back and forth, but, very arm's distance. Again, I was, was a, E3-ish enlisted rank, and he was a captain, so I had to be mindful about, his rank and my behavior towards him, or rather around him. So one day I was sitting at my desk, and we worked pretty close to each other, and he came over, and he said, Dietrich, and I said, yes, sir. He goes, you probably killed Esters, didn't you? And I, I sat there for a second. Now, of course, he was joking around, right? Sure. But I knew there were other people within earshot, so I had to be very, very mindful. So I you know, part of me said, you know, be very, very careful. You know, he's a captain. You know, you're nothing but a lance corporal. Be very mindful what you're about to say. Tread with caution, right? That's what my shoulder angel said, right, on the right-hand side. My other side said, hey, when you play stupid games, you win stupid prizes. So I said, well, sir, apparently not the right ones because you're still here, sir. Oh my God. Really good time. The other one I'll share real quick about my German heritage and in conjunction with my military background. So we go through basic training, go through boot camp, and I flew under the radar for the longest time. Like a good, you know, Luftwaffe pilot from Germany, I flew under the radar, right? Nobody could see me. And about halfway through the cycle, one of our drill instructors found out that I was from Germany. I don't know how he found out, but he did. From that point on forward, my nickname was Germany. He would just address me as Germany, right? So fast forward to, we did field training, and then we did the gas chamber. So we're all standing in you know, in formation, had our gas masks on, we got the training, we knew what to do, and we're all lined up facing the little, you know, the little hut with the smoke coming out of it. And said drill instructor comes running out of left field, and he goes, Germany, Germany, where are you? Where the hell are you, Germany? Raise your hand, goddammit, where are you? And I'm like, fuck, I can already hear it coming. I can see where this is going to go. So I raise my hand and I go, here, sir. And he comes running over. And the drill instructors, their campaign covers, right? Their brims are like, what, 4 inches, right? 360 around their head. So he comes over, he pushes the brim into my forehead, pushes me over by about 2 inches, and he starts whispering. I say whispering. He said it just loud enough for everyone around me to hear it. He goes, all right, now, Germany, Germany, we're about to go into the gas chamber. Now you'll know what it feels like. And what do you say, right? What do you do? I just, you know, you sit and go, yes, sir. And you can't say or do anything. You just take it, right?
I mean, you sort of had to see that one coming, though. I mean,
it's probably the only time he would ever get the chance to say that, right?
So, right, you know. And if he didn't take that opportunity to say it, I kind of would look at him a little bit differently, I would think,
right?
You know?
Right, it was a perfect opportunity. And I gave it to him, and I, you know.
It's not every day that a drill instructor is going to have a German person of German descent coming through the training,
yeah,
and being able to say that.
He tells this story from his side of, or his point of view, to his friends to this day. That's the only thing I can hope for.
Yeah. Well, you know, I see every once in a while, like, this wasn't a thing when I went through, because, and probably not you either, because this was, we were, I think, a little too old for this, but see drill sergeants now, we see videos posted on like TikTok and Instagram and things like that, where they're taking videos of with their cell phones of people mm-hmm. coming out of the gas chamber with the mm-hmm. snots and mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. everything dripping down their face, and they're just a train wreck, and it's funny to watch. We all were there, and we all looked that terrible too. Our drill sergeants actually had us drink a glass of milk before we went into the gas chamber,
no,
so it made everything extra.
No. It's funny now, but shitty.
It was pretty shitty, but it didn't work too. It was not pretty. That was an awful experience. But
yeah,
you know, they figured out ways to just us, and it was fun. And looking back at it, like, I get it. I probably would have done similar or the same things, at least, you know. But it's, you know, I guess they have to have their fun too, and it's kind of hard yelling and screaming all the time.
Sure, yeah,
really make it fun, you know.
Yeah,
so.
I end up meeting up with a drill instructor when I was, you know, stationed in Pendleton, and then a buddy of mine. We went out to somewhere in Pacific Beach or San Diego, somewhere down there, to drink and be silly. And he brought a friend out, and said friend was a drill instructor at the time. And I said, hey man, how is it like from your point of view? And he goes, man, you think you recruits had it hard? Like, we get no sleep.
Yeah.
We have barely enough time to just eat something. When I say eat something, you just inhale it down, because you have so little time. You have to look sharp all the time. You have to be on it all the time. You can't be tired. You always have to be presentable. And he's right. Like, we've never seen a drill instructor ever be out of, it's almost like they just took him out of the trap, right? Their clothes yeah. were always perfectly ironed and tailored and everything. They're always perfect ways, right?
Yeah.
And it's, anyway, at the end of the day, they're just guys or gals, right, that have to do a job, and they have to put on their pants one leg at a time. And it's got to be, looking from, seeing from their point of view, it's got to be a hard freaking job. And he put it very, he made an excellent point. He said, like I said, you think you had it hard. We get it like 10 times worse.
And they had to be perfect.
Yeah.
Like all the time. It was like, that's tiring.
Yeah.
To be perfect every single moment of every single day, not fumbling your words. Your uniform has to be perfection. If you're going to expect perfection from your recruits, your uniform also has to be perfect. Yeah. What, like that does have to be hard. I didn't have that opportunity to go that route, but you know, I've known some people who have, and they had it rough too.
I bet.
So talking about military, we talked kind of funny stories here.
Yeah.
Anything else from your military service, like how it maybe kind of helped kind of form your outlook on life or direction in life or anything like that?
Yeah. So I'll always say about my veteran, I've never regretted joining up, but I'm glad I got out when I did. I can't even say I had a hard, you know, military career. I was in for 4 years. I had an office job, you know, in an air conditioned area. I was working on computers the entire time. I was with a schools unit. We didn't deploy. The most interesting thing is we threw a live grenade on the, you know, on the range. I ended up pulling some strings and I was able to do spy rigging, right? The special purpose insertion extraction, where they, you know, where you get into a harness and they hook you onto a rope dangling off of a helicopter, right? And that was a good time. It really was fun. That was an experience. But I got lucky. I just happened to pull some strings and I happened to be at the right place at the right time. Other than that, my military service was extremely unremarkable, right? You know, 9/11 happened. We all remember where we were when it happened. And if you were in the military, I think we all agreed, we all knew that something was going to happen. Like, we were going to respond with something, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we did. And like I said, I was with a schools unit. We didn't deploy. The most we did is we pushed students through quicker so they can get deployed. So on one hand, I feel slightly guilty about not having done my part, you know, with quote unquote everyone else over there. On the other hand, I didn't have a choice, and I'm lucky and fortunate that I got out of my members in one piece, mentally and physically.
Yeah.
I don't envy anyone who had to go over there. I give them all the respect in the world, because it just, again, I feel like I missed out, and I feel a little bit of survivor's guilt because of it. But on the other hand, like I said, I thank my lucky stars that I came out of it unscathed.
For sure. And one thing I tell people who are in your shoes who have, they served during that time period, but didn't actively deploy or, you know, do those things, because it's not on for people like yourself to feel that they didn't do enough, or they, you know, weren't as good of a soldier or Marine or sailor or whatever, because they didn't deploy or whatever. But what I tell everybody is that you volunteered, you signed up, and you did what we asked you to do. And that's all that you can ever possibly do.
Fair.
And I there's no shame in that. You shouldn't, you know, feel, you know, guilty or anything like that because somebody else went and you didn't, or any of that stuff. You did what the Marine Corps asked you to do, and you got out, you know, at the end of your contract, and you were done, and you, they fulfilled their end of the deal. They provided you the training, you with a job and income and all the other benefits that go along with it, and you provided them with a Marine who could do whatever it was that they asked you to do and trained you to do. And so there's no shame in that. That's like the best you can hope for is just doing your job.
Thanks for the reframe. That actually does mean, I mean, that makes sense. I appreciate that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's not just for you, but that's for, you know, listeners too, because I know that's, I've talked to many people who've had that same type of mindset. And, you know, I did deploy to Afghanistan, but like, had I not deployed, I would have thought to myself, well, I did what I was supposed to do.
Yeah. Right?
Like, I couldn't like just go sneak on a plane and find myself over there. Like, that doesn't happen. So I did what I could. And, you know, even over there, maybe you can have so many different degrees, because yes, I did deploy, but did I have as tough of a deployment as other people? And so now we're starting to measure, sure, like whose deployment was worse.
Right. And worse. Right. It's like a suffering Olympics, right?
Yeah, right, exactly. And nobody wins in that. Like, you suffer, and that's awful. And there's no winning in that. It's almost like saying, you know, if someone is in 10 feet of water and they drown it, or someone's in 100 feet of water and they drowned, which one drowned worse?
Right.
They both drown. Yeah. It sucks for both of them. Yeah, so, yeah. So, you know, I see, you know, lots of veterans struggling with things like that, finding a sense of purpose, getting out of the service. Yeah. You know, I it's tough, but you know, it's stuff that you kind of have to, you know, I could tell you what I just said, and I, you know, the listeners can hear that, and you can take that for what it's worth, but you have to kind of do something with that yourself and get your own, you know, maybe what you're like, okay, cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I did all I could and I'm good to go now.
Yeah.
But maybe not, maybe you need a little extra twist on it to make it your own and cool. Well, you need to do that to figure it out, help yourself. And that's same thing with finding a sense of purpose. You know, some people get out and they immediately find what their next thing is, and they're good, and they don't have any troubles with moving on to that next thing after the military. Did you have any issues with that after getting out? Like, were you that identity tied into the Marine Corps, or were you pretty loose with that?
Yeah, I was fortunate in having placed a job pretty early on after me getting out. I moved to Vegas, like I said, and then about 2 months into it, I was still on terminal leave, so I was still getting my paychecks while I was burning my leave, my PTO time. So I was still financially stable, and then I thankfully, you know, scored a job that then supported me moving forward. There were times, though, when I missed the military lifestyle just for the structure, right? Because military, I'm not saying it was, but it was on a cadence, right? You get up, you go to work, you do your PT, you go home, you clean your room, and, you know, it's all done on a fairly simple, you know, 10-step checklist, right? And as long as you can follow those steps, you'll be okay. And I did have, I wouldn't say a problem, but it took a little bit of time getting adjusted to civilian life. Is, I guess, the feedback I got from an old boss is, she told me, you were cussing like a sailor. Like, every other word out of you was four letters. And I go, yeah, that sounds about right. But thankfully, I had patient coworkers, and a lot of my coworkers were military as well. But had I not had a job lined up, and had I not had a set that I could carry over into civilian life, I did toy with the idea of going back into it, but then I quickly abandoned that once I realized that, no, I like having my freedom to go out and do silly things, especially living in Vegas. So the structure definitely is one thing I did miss. Another thing too, my Lord, civilians can be so freaking, we always use the term nasty civilians, right? When we're in the service. And sometimes these freaking civilians can be so disorganized and unprofessional, right? And then all those adjectives that you know, fit civilian lifestyle. So that took a little bit of getting used to, but I'm one of those civilians now too, so that's okay.
So you kind of let it slip a bit, right?
Yeah, a little bit of adjustment, a little bit of meat in the middle, right?
Yeah, sure. And that's probably a healthy way to look at it, though, is that meeting in the middle, because there's some things from the military that you can take with you, like being on time and being organized and a lot of those other qualities that you might take away, that those things are good. Like, if you're on time, like, no one's going to be like, oh my gosh, look at this guy. He's always showing up
this
on time.
This dork always showing up 15 minutes early. Hell no, that's how we get you promoted, you know?
Exactly, right? Like, those are good things. So yeah, do more of that. But there's other things that other, you know, some people in the military might be taking away, like, I don't know, like a swaler. It's like a sailor. And, you know, not being able to, you know, turn that off. That might be a problem in some civilian jobs.
Being a little too direct and giving people verbal encouragement is frowned civilian sector.
Yeah, okay? Right. And could you imagine being a boss in the civilian world and making your subordinates do push-ups or something because they, you know, missed a deadline or something like that? That's not going to work.
Maybe it'll give some better results. You mentioned coworkers.
You might actually get a visit from HR.
That's right.
if you do that.
Like, hey, they lost 5 pounds. I'm just saying, you know.
I've
seen the other day, they were like, how is it dealing with veterans, you know, when you at the workplace? And by and large, some really great veteran coworkers, no matter what branch they're in. I've also dealt with a lot of shitbirds, right? So just because you're a veteran does not automatically mean that you are a good worker, coworker, what have you. But one thing I will say about veterans, by and large, is that no matter, like, say, what rank you are, what title you have in the company, or what title they have, for the most part, when it comes down to crunch time and you need to get work done, you can tell if you're a line worker and you need to tell a director, hey, so-and-so, I need you to do X, Y, Z, right? There's a certain amount of respect between or amongst veterans that, you know, when it's time to do work, title and rank largely goes out the window, mm-hmm. and you take the other person's word for it. You're like, you know, I'm on it. You got it.
Yeah, right.
And that's maybe a bit of a culture shock to, you know, between military and civilian, where, you know, yes, sure, in the military, there is a sure, like where the lower people, you know, stuff rolls downhill and mm-hmm. it ends up getting down to them. But like you said, when it's crunch time and stuff needs to get done, people just work together. Yep. Rank you're wearing on your shirt.
That's right.
You work together, yeah. and it's teamwork that gets the job done.
Yeah.
And I think we inherently understand that how teamwork works. Of course, like you were saying before, of course you want to be respectful to those who are superior to you. You want to be respectful to everybody, but have the right military bearing with mm-hmm. those people who are placed above you. But at the same time, you got to let them know, hey, I need help in order to accomplish this. And yeah. they're there to make sure that you have all the resources yeah. that you need. And if you take that out into the civilian world, sometimes it's like, well, I'm your boss. You don't get to tell me what to do.
That's right.
You know, and that a little different way of looking at it. And it might actually be shocking to some civilians to realize that, like, it's kind of okay in certain circumstances to let your superiors know, you know, and follow the chain of command. Like, mm-hmm. you're not going to jump to mm-hmm. you know, directly to your captain if you have a, you know, a squad leader or something that you can go to, you'll go to that person first. But you know, you do what you need to do to get the yeah. job done and work together as a team.
A little courage and a little assertiveness is not a bad thing.
Yeah, yeah, and when you have a bunch of alpha personalities together, there's going to be a lot of assertiveness, and you have to
sure.
learn how to really assert yourself yeah. so that you don't end up getting trampled on, because everybody is going to be asserting themselves in one way or another. So.
I agree with that. I also believe that the mark of a truly good leader is that a leader can also be a good follower, right? To your point, mm. if you have a room full of alphas and they all want to be the chief, right? That's fine. There can only be one chief and everybody else has to be, you know, workers.
Yeah.
And I think a telltale sign of a really good leader is a leader can say, cool, tell me what to do. Tell me where you need me.
Yeah, there's that, and there's also the other side of that too, where even if you're a junior person, mm-hmm. knowing that you have the ability to step up into a leadership role if
yeah.
the situation dictates, you know, that yeah. you can just jump right in and say, I see that there's something wrong here. I'm not going to wait to be told to go fix it. I'm just
yep.
going to go jump in and fix it.
Yep.
There's a story that was. One of the guests told a couple months ago on the show, and it was about private. His platoon sergeant was pinned down by enemy fire, and so the platoon sergeant couldn't give in to anybody else in the platoon. If he lifted his head up, he was going to get shot, and so he couldn't do that. So this private saw what was going on, and so he took it upon himself to say, hey, you know what? I need to move myself over here so I can go return fire and, you know, provide cover for my platoon sergeant so he can mm-hmm. get out of there. Nobody had to tell him what to do. He just took it upon himself to go
yep.
do it. If he waited for the order to go do that, the guy might not have made it. And that would have been a tragedy, but he did. And so he took it upon himself and he went and did it. But it's the same. I mean, anything in life, you can just take charge. You see garbage on the floor. Like, you don't have to wait for someone to come and clean it up, like the janitor or something.
I literally was going to say, it's funny you mentioned picking up garbage. Our boss, I work in IT.
Okay.
I've always been an IT professional. Our boss, our C-level executive, he has this phrase, you pick up digital trash. When you see trash laying around, right, we all
sure.
work on computers and stuff. When you see digital trash, you pick it up, to your point, right? When you see trash on the ground, you pick it up. Same thing in IT, right? So same thing about being self-motivated and just doing the right thing, right?
Well, and that's a different way of thinking about it too, but it's still important, because that digital trash, whether it's old files that nobody's using, mm-hmm. You don't need to accumulate these files that are outdated,
they're
you know, software that no one's using anymore. Yeah. Well, uninstall it. You don't need it there anymore or whatever. Like, those things just take up room on a computer, and they could slow things down. They could cause all sorts of other problems too. And like, get rid of it. And maybe it's a piece of physical trash. Maybe it's a piece of digital trash. Don't need that thing anymore. And so, but you don't have to wait to be told no or yes, go to that issue or whatever. So
right.
It's interesting though. It's just a mindset that we have, that, you know, it's to be able to sort of impart some of that onto other folks, like in the civilian world, because it seems like not enough of them really have that kind of mindset. And so it's nice when we're able to work with them and show them. And sometimes you see the light bulb go off with them, and then they understand, like, oh, wow, that's sense. Maybe mm-hmm. I should do things that way myself. And, you know, so it kind of helps everybody out. But so you got out of the military, got right into the civilian world. Did you have kind of like a goal in mind when you were there? Did you know what you wanted to be doing, or stumble around until you figured it out? What did success look like when you were getting out?
Yeah, it's kind of like the that interview question, right? Where do you see yourself in 5 years, right? But how do you measure success? I was 24 years old. I was coming out of, you know, living in or being stationed in Southern California. And even back then in 2000, San Diego-ish, in that general area, was way too expensive for a single dude like myself who didn't have a job lined up to make it down there, eventually speaking. I didn't have a job lined up, didn't have a place to live. So I decided to pack my stuff and move to Vegas. There's a little story that with that involved a girl I was dating and a Hispanic couple that I lived with until things went south there. I can tell you that story some other time. It takes about half an hour from start to finish.
When you said there's a story involved, I knew it had to do with a girl at some point. Yeah, 100%. Had to be involved somehow in there. So anyway, that went without saying.
Absolutely. No, I moved to Vegas. And like I said, I got lucky that I scored it kind of early on in my into me just being me, right? Living my life outside the military. Going back to the interview question, what does success look like to you? Where do you want to be in 5 years? I don't have an answer to say, well, I want to do this or have this much money or drive this kind of car or have these kind of friends. All I can say confidently is that I don't know what it'll look like, but I know I'll be happy doing it. And I think that really is one of those lessons learned the hard way, that at the end of the day, you have to do what makes you happy, right? Obviously within, legal. But at the end of the day, your happiness is ultimately the most important thing in the world, and nobody else will do it for you. So, I don't know. Again, going back to what I said earlier, you're responsible. You know, you need to take ownership for everything that happens to you. I was in a fraternity at UNLV, Nevada, Las Vegas here, many years ago. And a lot of the military, kind of ways of thinking and the ways of doing things are brought into it, because there's a lot of similarities between, military lifestyle and dealing with a bunch of, 18, 19-year-old kids who want to join fraternity, right? Dealing with a bunch of boys that have a lot of bravado but very little brain power, right? And I was there too. We've all been there, right? Yeah. I would tell our pledges, right? Think of them as like recruits in boot camp. I would tell our pledges, be like, look, whatever you make of yourself here is up to you. You may have been the quarterback in high school. You may have been the captain of the whatever team, in high school. That doesn't mean a damn thing here. You all start at square one. Whatever you make of yourself here is up to you. If you, look back in your life, say 2 years from now, and you're realizing the life that you want, it's up to you. No one's going to give this to you, right? So you have no one to blame but yourself. I think that goes, the same with civilian life or real life. You're ultimately responsible for everything, right? Your path. And tying it back around to what I just said earlier, your happiness should be the very first thing that you cater to and work towards.
I don't think I could have said that better. Absolutely.
Thank you.
The happiness is definitely important, and there's too many people job just to get
go through the motions.
Something just to go through the motions, exactly, and then they end up hating it, and they don't even last a year or two, and that's not the best way to get your career started by jumping out within the first couple of years. And, people do it, and they do eventually get into something that they enjoy. But I think having that maybe introspective look into, like, what really do I want from life. What's going to make me happy? Where do I want to live? What do I want to be doing? Do I want to be married? Do I want to have kids? Do I want a house? Do I want, you know, an apartment? What is it that I want from life, and how do I get there? And you know, I was talking to somebody else the other day, and it's kind of like the military. You kind of sandbox it, you know, plan out like what do I need to do to accomplish this mission, whatever this mission is, and let's get there. And figure out how do I make this happen. Maybe I need to go back to school. Maybe I need to, you know, get some additional training or a certificate, degree, you know, something, whatever it is. Figure it out. Go do those things. There's available to help you out with that if you need it. But, you know, go do those things. And then, you know, maybe you're not going to be working your dream job right off the bat, but, you know, eventually you'll get there, you know, by working your way up. You know, and figuring out what those steps are.
Yeah, I agree. Sorry to cut you off. When you mentioned that, it jogged my memory. A piece that I write about in the book about changing your lifestyle to that you're not, when you want something, you have two ways of going at it. You can either go after it and put work and time and effort into pursuing that, or you can build a lifestyle that naturally attracts those things towards you.
Okay.
Right? So whether it be jobs or relationships, friendships, you know, it's one thing to pursue it. It's another thing to have those things be attracted to you because of the lifestyle that you've built for yourself.
Sure. Yeah. Both. Yeah, that's exactly right. Man, these are some good topics. And
buy my book, right?
I know.
Right now is not a good time for the
plug? Yeah, go do the plug. Yeah.
Okay. So if you go to andysbook.com, there is a picture of me holding it up. There's a link to the Amazon page. You're welcome to click on that and buy it. However, if you go to andysbook.com/gift, punch in your information, and I'll send you. I have a couple copies left here. I'm more to send you one, right? If you go on Amazon, right, I get $4.80. It really is negligible, right? I'd rather me send it to you and then you enjoy reading it. And then if you want to leave me a review afterwards, a genuine review, right? And I'll tell people genuine. If you liked it, say that. If you didn't like it, say that too. Like, it's perfectly fine. Like, I have thick skin, I can handle it. Please leave me a genuine review of the writing. And I hope you enjoyed I hope you enjoy reading it as much as I did writing it.
Well, and you know, talking to someone like yourself, I got to know a little bit about your story, and hearing the passion that you had for it, the way you were talking about it, it just seemed like it's like you said, it was a passion project. It definitely, the passion kind of came through as you were talking about it. And for if you're interested, definitely go get a copy of the book and check it out. I think it'll definitely be an interesting read, and you'll get a lot out of it and definitely enjoy it. So, you know, Andy, I really do appreciate you coming on the show. I appreciate you sharing your story, you know, your time in, you know, growing up in Germany to come, which God only knows why.
you chose out of it. God only knows why. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, your time in the Marine Corps and, you know, to where you are today, you know, sitting pretty. I'm guessing probably little Andy there in Germany probably wouldn't be expecting that you'd be here in Las Vegas at this point, but who knows, you know, life has a lot of different curves at you and you never know where you're going to end up.
I always think about what would have happened had I, you know, like the choices you make, the paths you take in life, right? There was an opportunity for me to go to Japan instead of Pendleton, right? I could have just stayed in Fairbanks, you know, doing whatever the hell I was going to do there. I go to college and get, you know, whatever. I mean, I always wonder how my life would have kind of unfolded had I taken one of those other paths. You know, maybe that could be like a Black Mirror episode. Maybe when you die, you get to see all the different choices you didn't make and you could live through those paths. I don't know, right? But I always kind of wonder what would have happened to me. Like, I wouldn't live the life I'm living right now. I hope I'll be living a comparable life. But what would have happened had I just not made that one decision? My whole life would have been changed.
It's amazing how many things could change from just one decision.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you think about the number of decisions that had to be made in order for us to even exist is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Never mind where would I be in life just for us to exist. Talking back hundreds and hundreds of years, all the decisions and the people that needed to meet in order for that to happen. It's, you know, it's pretty incredible. But
there was a really interesting, it was a topic on Reddit. It was, you know, someone said, I have a, you know, can you give me your best butterfly effect story? And it was the guy tied together the Kardashians' fame with a football game of some, I don't remember the details of how it started, but basically there's a football game that was won that got OJ to be famous, and then his fame catapulted him to get married and meet Nicole Brown, it was, right? Yeah. And that whole story unfolded, and then of course the murder, and then the lawsuit, and then the Kardashians, and the, you know, the lawyer, and then all these things kind of unfolded together. And they're like, had this one football game not ended, or had it not ended in this kind of a way, or that one pass wouldn't have happened, then the Kardashians wouldn't be who they are today, because they never would have gotten famous, because their dad was never, that ended the whole, just brings it all back, like butterfly effect style. And I go, I think about that, and I go, how weird is that? That one little thing like that, God knows how many years ago, just then makes this happen. It's just, it's the most bizarre thing when you think about it.
And there are so many people out there who probably can attribute something in their life to something like that.
Sure.
But they may not even know what that thing is. But if you peel back the onion, you go back on and look through all the layers that make them who they are, eventually you might be able to find that thing that had that one thing not happened. Had Andy not shown up in Alaska, we would not be sitting here talking today, probably.
There was a really good episode, Star Trek Voyager, from many, many years ago, if you're a Star Trek fan. And the premise was, there was a ship that, I don't know, the guy who was the captain, his people were obliterated because of an asteroid, or whatever hell the storyline was. And this ship was able to change historical events so that then the future would be shaped in a different way, and had the ability to jump in between or act in a certain way that it could shape the different paths that the future would take. And I remember from, you know, the bits and pieces I do remember, it showed in a very visual way all the different storylines and story paths that a single action would then have effects on. And it says, well, if you do this one thing here, then in 1,000 years, this other thing will be affected, which is what you don't want, right? So it just, the concept was very interesting.
That is an interesting concept. And, you know, I think we've covered quite a few interesting concepts in this episode, but
anymore.
I'm sure you do. And I'm sure there's a bunch of them in the book. So again, play stupid games, win stupid prizes. The link in the show notes for the listeners, definitely go check it out. Andy, again, thank you so much. You know, and I do appreciate you coming on the show. And
thanks for talking to you. Let's do it again.
Yeah,
absolutely. Oh, yeah.